Hey, everybody. Aaron here, and we're back with my buddy Jim to talk about another bald movie today. It's 1996's Trainspotting, which we were recently drugged for not having seen on our forums and social media and elsewhere. So we rectified this. Trainspotting, of course, is directed by Danny Boyle, who not only has directed the sequel T2, Trainspotting, he's also directed The Beach, 28 Days Later, Sunshine, Slumdog Millionaire, 127 Hours, Steve Jobs, and Yesterday. He wrote this with John Hodge, who's the primary credit on a screenplay, who also... they collaborated on Danny's first film, Shallow Grave, which also I think is one of Ewan McGregor's first films, in 94. Trainspotting, A Life Less Ordinary, The Beach, again, The Final Curtain, and is based on a Scottish novel, Trainspotting, by Irvine Welsh. It stars, as I mentioned, Ewan McGregor, Ewan Brimmer, a lot of Ewans, Johnny Lee Miller, Kevin McKidd, Robert Carlyle. It's the first appearance of a 19-year-old Kelly MacDonald on film. And Peter Mullen, which if you don't recognize his name, if you're watching Westworld, you've gone all the way down with him as Jim Delos. Jim,
yeah.
What did you think? Have you seen Trainspotting before? Well, of course not. It's how we ended in this predicament.
It's my first time seeing it.
First time seeing. What did you think?
I thought it was amazing. I guess I didn't really know what to expect out of this movie, even though people talk about it as like one of the definitive and quintessential drug films of certainly the 90s, but maybe of all time. And I think they're right about that. After having seen it once, it was kind of amazing. And I have this new... I guess between like this and 28 Days Later, which is one of my all-time favorite zombie films, Sunshine, which is just like this eerily beautiful
mm-hmm.
film.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those starring, what's his name? Cillian Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to like really, really appreciate Danny Boyle's catalog. I've seen Slumdog Millionaire. I didn't think it was like as amazing as everyone seemed to think it was when it came out. I thought it was very, very good.
Sure. But it's definitely a mass appeal type of thing.
Right. I appreciate some of his quirkier, more niche-y stuff, and this definitely fits in there.
Oh, yeah.
Man, I'm impressed.
I mean, what they did with a low budget, some of the practical effects they did of just like, you know, doing drugs and like, you know, him going diving into the worst toilet in Scotland to retrieve just a pittance worth of drugs. Some stuff was just so god awful, but so well executed and on such an obviously low budget. I like this movie. So you've seen Requiem for a Dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
I actually think this is a better drug film because I felt like this did a better job of selling me why a person would find themselves in this situation. Like, what is the initial appeal? Why do you keep doing it? What is the sense of community here that keeps you locked into it? And because it was like you had this ups and downs and kind of manic fun in the beginning, I felt like the gut punches landed. They came out of nowhere. And it felt like authentic to like coming out of a heroin haze and like, oh, God, this fucking heavy thing. What are we going to do? Well, of course, before we do anything, we're going to do more heroin. And there's just like that kind of I got it, you know, like a Requiem for a Dream feels more like a cautionary tale. This feels very much more like this is just the reality of being really into a drug culture.
I think you're right. I mean, one of the things I noticed is how they oscillate between, you know, the highs and the lows of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess, one of the parts that of the whole experience that Requiem doesn't get at is kind of the highs, you know, for as many highs as are in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't show you the good times, right? The good parts of being a heroin addict. Whereas this movie does. And it has a certain sort of appeal, I think. It's certainly nothing I would ever want to get mixed up in. I'm a not even once on heroin kind of guy.
Same.
But I understand. Yeah, after watching this movie, like you said, it kind of gives you a 360 view of the whole thing. It makes you understand why people who, you know, do give it a shot sort of get caught up in the thing. And I think Tommy is maybe the most vivid example of that, and the most tragic, certainly, in this movie.
Yeah, and there's just... That's the other thing that felt right. Like, these codependent, like, terrible relationships where you just use people, but it's okay because they'll use you if they get a chance, and the people, like, and you have no camaraderie with anyone that's in the straight world because they don't understand. They're going to judge you. They're going to try to get you locked up, so fuck them. Like, it really paints a picture of how you can get, and, like, there's a kind of a rational, you know, as a young person, it's like, oh, you know, they want me to be a normal person. They want me to get on this path. They want me to choose these various things. I'm just going to refuse to choose. And I'm reminded of the Rush song about, you know, if you fail to make a choice, or if you refuse to choose, you still made a choice. And it kind of shows, like, there's a reason that a lot of people choose not to just drop out of society, because there's a few ways where that can go right, like some kind of on Walden Pond situation where you go and, you know, have a sustainable garden in some kind of bumfuck Wyoming and you homestead. But, you know, if you do it this way where you just get a squat in a flat and shoot up all day, things just go very, very badly. And yeah, I like it. It felt like dirtier, more authentic, more real than like Requiem, which even when it's showing disgusting things is well lit and kind of like somewhat glamorous. I mean, I'm not going to say Requiem romanticizes heroin. It's just, it's got such a slick production that it feels like it in comparison to this Trainspotting deal.
Gotcha. And I don't want to like, I do want to say we're going to get into spoilers here eventually, but maybe we should talk a little bit about the production, because you've been talking about the budget.
Yeah.
Apparently this thing had like a 1.5 million pound budget, or euro pound. I don't know what they're using in 96.
Sure.
Probably a euro.
I think they stuck with the pound, didn't they? Like that was one of the things that even they maintained a pound sterling.
Even in the face of joining the EU?
Yeah, yeah.
Weird. Yeah, so... 1.5 million euros, pounds, whatever, made like 50 times that. It actually had a pretty good box office run. And you can see the low budget, but also I was kind of surprised at some of the, I guess, the things about the production from a casting standpoint, because this is a Scottish film.
Yes.
And it takes place in Edinburgh, right?
Edinburgh.
Or, yeah, however the Scottish say it. But you've got a couple of actors in here who are Scottish.
Uh-huh.
You've got, like, I mean, Ewan McGregor is Scottish, obviously.
Right.
This Ewan Brimner guy who plays Spud is Scottish. Kelly MacDonald, I think, is Scottish. But then you've got guys like Johnny Lee Miller who are English-American. And you've got the guy who plays Tommy is American as well. And I'm thinking, how the hell did they get cast in this movie? Because it's like a small-time director at this point, right? Mm. Danny Boyle was not known for anything, really. And you've got a couple of American actors doing Scottish accents in a Scottish film taking place in Scotland. It's really weird to me that you would cast Johnny Lee Miller the year after he did Hackers.
That's what I kept on. Like, every time he popped up, I'm like, it's the douche from Hackers, man.
Yeah, this is zero cool, right? This is
I don't know. Maybe those were guys were trying to not be typecast as douchey hacker type roles, and were asking their agent to get them into some kind of low budget, weird experimental thing. Because you're right. I assumed that they were all at least in the UK. I didn't know that you actually had people Americans.
No, I mean, yeah, two of the main cast are American, which was strange to me. But yeah, I like Johnny Lee Miller a lot, and I think he does passable work here as a Scot. But I think I really appreciate his career, and it's kind of the same way I appreciate Danny Boyle's catalog, which is like his nichier stuff, his smaller stuff, maybe the stuff that isn't meant for mainstream consumption. Because Johnny Lee Miller, you know, he's gone on to do... played Sherlock Holmes in Elementary or whatever, a modern day Sherlock.
Oh shit.
He was in season 5 of Dexter, which I really liked him in. But some of his nichier stuff, like this now, having seen it, and Hackers is kind of what I grew up with Johnny Lee Miller in. And that's what I think of him as, is like this niche-y, kind of low budget, sort of like doing stuff around the fringes of society. Because Hackers and heroin addicts are about as fringy as you can get in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
So I really appreciate that he plays Sick Boy in this.
Although knowing what I know about hacking, maybe I should be skeptical about this is like how heroin culture really is.
Right, right.
Maybe that was heroin culture 30 years ago, but it's all different heroin game now. No, I think that's
the most accurate.
And I think that's why I have come to appreciate that the Just Say No to Drugs campaigns are actually, I wonder if they haven't done more harm than good. Because when you tell people that, like, if you try, you know, you try marijuana, you get reefer madness. You snort a little coke, your brain will be fried. If you do, like, and kids do, you know, mess around with shit and find out, you know what, I'm still here the next day and everything's cool. And then someone offers you heroin and it's just like, we should talk about, like, you know, there's alcohol and there's caffeine and there's marijuana and there's, you know, cocaine and there's ecstasy and then there's meth and then there's heroin and they're fundamentally in a different kind of class of things. Like these opioids, it just seems like, you know, we found out in America, you know, like a lot of people that got hooked on heroin got a legal dose of painkilling medicine. I mean, I grew up like I was 18 to mid 20s during the whole like, oh, pain revolution. No one has to live under pain anymore. We have so much effective pain treatments. Go to your doctor, talk to them about get on Vicodin or whatever. And it seems like it's a uniquely hard thing to avoid getting addicted to, and then to kick, it's just a fucking nightmare. And
yeah, and they kind of address that right up front in the movie, right, where they're talking about the effect of it, the feeling of being on heroin, where it's take the best orgasm you've ever had, times it by 1,000, that doesn't even come close to the feeling of doing heroin.
And the first few, the other thing I've heard that's seductive about heroin is that for the first few times you're on it, it just makes everything better. Like you can, your job is like infinitely more interesting and easy to get through. Like if you had a bad family situation, that stuff doesn't matter as much. It just helps you be like a normal human being, helps you sleep. But then when you go from that to like needing it and needing ever more quantities just to feel okay, figuring out how to spin, you know, to constantly get, you know, the only thing that's important is the next hit. That's where it's like, you know, you don't know that the trap is set until you're well into the physical dependency. It's like I said, it's a really scary drug. It's funny because about 30 minutes into it, Jack walked in, want to know what I was watching. I was about to be like, I don't know if this. And I'm like, you know what? You're 13 going on 14. Sit your ass. Yeah, sit down. Let's watch this movie. And it blew his mind because he's kept on saying, like, ABC. Why is this happening? And I'm like,
yeah,
heroin, man, heroin. Like these people can't literally help themselves. And I think it really was affecting, like when, you know, seeing some of these people trying to go through detox or even like multiple rounds of detox, seeing just like bad decisions compound with bad decisions. And you know why? Because every time you make a bad decision and it bites you in the ass, you feel really bad. And man, gonna have to have another hit of heroin. Gonna have to have a rally needle or something. And it's just like that just locks you in that cycle.
And I've never seen a movie give a more like stark example of that than this movie does. I mean, when that, so there's this question that kept popping up in my notes over and over again for the first half of this movie.
We're going to go right now is where we're going to go to massive spoilers. So if you haven't seen it, you should, because there's a couple moments where I'm glad I thought this movie was certainly about heroin, but I thought it got its name from like them surfing on trains because they're suicidal. Mm-hmm. Was that even a movie or did I completely invent that there was a,
it sounds like the Lost Boys, honestly. Okay. It sounds like them
hanging off the train tracks. But I thought there was a movie about people like surfing on high speed trains in Europe or maybe even Japan. And I thought it was this movie. It's not. It's not. So take all that ignorance and watch this movie because there's a couple twists and turns that really work if you don't see them coming. Yeah. Jim, proceed.
All right. Now that everybody's seen the film, a couple times in my notes, I wrote down this question. whose baby is this?
Yup.
And man, do they pay that off. Like, you want to see an example of substance abuse and the way that abusers lean on that substance for everything in their life, right down to like the strength to carry on. It's in this movie, and I don't think I've ever seen such a stark example of it.
And yeah, I remember seeing that baby kind of like playing around the edges. I'm like, oh, it kind of looks healthy. Like, I don't know, maybe this will, you know, turn out okay. And you kept on seeing, it. And then like, I'd kind of forgotten about that until it turns around. And yeah, it's like that fucking dead baby is one of the most starkest, like, and the immediate aftermath of that, what happens, and yeah, they all, and like, and then it never resolves. Like, as I was thinking, like, oh, this is where people are going to go to jail. This is people, but like, it just kind of goes away. And that felt, I'm like, okay, this actually feels like they probably just dumped it somewhere and no one's going to know about it for years and years and years if they ever find out about it.
Right.
And like that's what feels like heroin. Like, even how they led into that, like, you know, they are all clean and they're doing fine, and then they've decided they can't handle society because, you know, they've got, seems like a lot of these, you know, if you're poor and Scottish, it's, you share a lot of things in common with being poor and American, and that you feel like there's nothing, you know, society has nothing to offer you, that there's, it's all a rigged game. So why not do heroin? And just like, you know, the mother screaming, and like Ewan McGregor's character, Rent, trying to figure out like, why is she screaming? How long has she been screaming? Has anyone said anything for like, and then I started being like, oh, Jesus, they've done heroin so much that they just completely forgotten about this baby.
Yeah.
And it was tough to watch.
Like, I've always wanted to see the zombie baby, but not like this.
Not like this. Not like this.
My God.
And they do such great work with him when he's in his parents, like, Gior Mormont, the old bear, is his dad in this. Mm-hmm. And he's a fucking dad, and he barricades his son into his room, and in a room full of trains. And he just goes through these intense scenes of psychosis, and they do this really great thing where like, he's in this single bed, and he goes under the sheets, and like, one of his mates comes and threatens to kick his ass, and then rolls, and then he takes the covers. And I think that's a single camera break, but it's like, they just optically set it up where these illusions felt so real because they were happening in the camera frame and the camera lens was seeing it. But they just, like, almost like a magician, were rearranging the set and rearranging the scenery to make the stuff pay off. Like, him crawling into that toilet. Like, there's this magical kind of realism going on that is extraordinarily effective, showing someone at the depths of a heroin binge and also showing them in the depths of heroin withdrawal.
Well, let's amazing. Just talk briefly about how that scene has aged like a fine wine. That scene is one thing when you're viewing it from the perspective of a fresh-faced nobody who is Ewan McGregor.
Yeah. Yeah.
That scene is an entirely different thing when you're viewing it from the perspective of, this man has played Obi-Wan Kenobi, and he's crawling face first into the worst toilet in Scotland.
He's sang pretty songs opposite of Nicole Kidman. He's
yeah, no, fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah. And it's, oh God, like, there's very
he
few.
He spits the water out when he comes out of.
Ugh. Man, there's very few scenes that make me gag, but the idea that he has to shit so bad that he's going to use this toilet, and then halfway through realizing, oh God, my drugs. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, no,
which,
no.
Why? And
I swear to God, I almost threw up.
Why? Okay, so A, why even bother with the toilet? I mean, clearly you're not the first person to shit on the floor in this bathroom.
Yeah.
What is actually happening here? Because when he gets out of the toilet, which I have to assume is just a fever dream, right? This is not, he's not literally crawled
physically into the toilet. I think he had to go way down into the back of the toilet to find those suppositories.
Okay, but when he gets home, he's soaked head to toe.
Yeah. Is he sweating, or is it just like, again, that magical realism thing? Because they did show that, like, you know, that you have like a whole bunch of different crazy side effects from these drugs.
They do a great job even with that low budget, right? Because like, you can tell he's crawling into like, shit, what is it called when you cut something in half to see the inside of it?
Oh yeah, a cutaway or cross section.
Yeah, he's crawling into like a reverse cross section of a toilet here where we can only see the good side.
Yeah.
And he's like crawling past the toilet, but
Yeah. It looks great.
it really works. Yeah, the effect is really cool.
Yeah, and then the actual swimming, like I imagine they spent like a good chunk of the movie just doing underwater filming with Ewan McGregor in this disgusting
Yeah.
toilet.
It's brilliant. I loved it.
Yeah. And again, like I said, the practical effects, I could talk all day about like the way they weave like the different visions and him twisting and turning into sheets and during the pretty prolonged effect of him going cold turkey. But I also want to talk about go back to kind of the sociological things because like the idea that this guy wants to go clean and gets clean at several times in this movie and always finds him way back, I think is interesting because it seems like there's a lot of like things like talking about his he got a Valium from his mother the first time he tries to kick it, and he's like, you know, because she's one of the socially acceptable types of drug addicts, you know, she's a housewife and you know maybe she has a whole glass of, you know, a whole bottle of wine every night and she has a couple Valiums, but you know that's fine, she's holding it together. And then the idea that you, as a heroin addict, you drive away anyone that can give you a hand up or is respectable. And you're left with just these worse dregs, and then they're your mates. Like several points in third, like, well, they're my mates. What are you going to do? Some of them aren't even drug addicts. Like, oh God, what was that, Benny? The psychopath?
Begbie?
Begbie, yes.
Yeah.
Like guys like Begbie who are proud of not putting that shite in my body, but he's so fucked up and addicted to this rage and the power that he has over people that he might as well. He actually would probably be better off. The heroin would like kind of fucking smooth him out. But you're just left with this like self-reinforcing, like, you know, if you try to get something together, your mates steal it all to get a next score. You know, you got a stable relationship, your mate steals your porn tape that gets you broken up with your girlfriend that spirals you into your own drug addiction. You're broke and you're on heroin, you don't give a shit about clean needles, so you give each other HIV. It's like just this everyone has a chance to hold the misery bucket, and as they pass it from mate to mate, it just sloshes all over him, and it's
And that somehow drives them closer together, right? Like that tightens the bonds instead of like the normal reaction, which would be this person is detrimental to my life. It's more like you hold more tightly to those people because that's all you've got.
Yeah, and I feel like to some people there again, like that's one of the underappreciated privileges of having like good family and a reasonable amount of wealth or being kind of, you know, well off is that when you are growing up in a poor community, the people that you have to associate are limited, or the people that will associate with you are limited. And you're always taught that, like, hey, you should stick by your friends. You shouldn't narc on your friends. Your friends are, you know, should be like a bond that lasts for life. And that works against people that get themselves in a situation because I've certainly gone through multiple cycles of weaning out friends. Like, you know, when I went from like elementary school to high school, like I had to tighten my friend circle because some of my friends started getting in some crazy fucking shit. When I went into adulthood, I had to, there's a couple other people that were going to hit the skids and going to burn out. And, you know, you had to make a decision about whether you're going to join them in that spiral or you're going to try to do something better. And then I went through that again in a cycle in like kind of my middle life when I kind of refactored my. And, but it's, I recognize that that's a very tough decision to do, and it seems like it's a betrayal, and it seems like you're the asshole every single time you do it.
And there's a certain amount of privilege to even being in that position. Like
Sure.
the idea that, because, you know, look at that from the other side, right? The person who's being cut out because they're perceived as less than, or they can't, you know, they can't keep up, that kind of thing. That's who these people are, right?
Right.
And so I'm constantly in awe of Roger Ebert's ability to see a movie and break down its fundamental concepts into just this cohesive narrative that he constructs. His review on this film is so fucking good.
Yep.
He takes all of the crazy shit that's going on in this, and he just lays it all out and says, these people, you know, they don't get stuck in this because it's necessarily all they have, though that is part of it, but it's like these people understand what you're going through too, and they're the only ones who can. Like the parents who are telling you, oh, you need to get off this shit, why are you putting this shit in your body? They don't understand it. The people like Frank Begbie in this scene don't understand it, but they're somehow, I don't know, in on this group. But these people who go through this with you are the only people who understand it. And so, like, you know, the people who would say, well, you just need to cut these people out of your life, I think that's a privileged point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they did cut these people out of their life, what would they have?
They'd have nothing. They'd have to rebuild.
Yeah.
And also, especially, it's one thing to do it, like, early before you go down that spiral. But if you go down the spiral and you try to cut them out then, it's like you got the problem of being a junkie and all the negative stigma that it goes trying to re-enter society, normal society. And you see, like, what great measures Rent takes to break this cycle. Like, he gets clean. He goes from Edinburgh to London. He starts a career. It's taking off. But this fucking life finds him, and in the form of Bigsby, you know, like, wanting to hide out from the law. And suddenly he starts getting sucked back into it. And that, like, one...
Yeah.
Moment, okay, well, he's my mate, okay, fine, like, I don't want him to go to jail, that sucks. That one fucking moment of, like, weakness, mercy, that's what I'm saying is so fucked up, because when you're a kid, you get all these mixed messages, you know, you got your parents saying you got to be careful who you follow around, but then you also got Gandalf saying, hey, maybe you should feel bad for Smeagol and Gollum, and, you know, and you know, like, where, what, and sometimes it's a huge decision, like, who you give clemency and who you give mercy to and who you forgive and who you help, you know, sometimes can be a super rewarding experience. It gets repaid tenfold later on in your life, which I've experienced. Sometimes it can be a fucking boat anchor that tries to drag you down, which I also have experienced in my life. It's just, you're right. And I think it's funny because Roger Ebert gets us a 3 out of 4 stars. And I felt like, He didn't give it the fourth. He held the fourth star because, like, the conclusion of the movie is just too depressing. Like, gotcha. You know, like, what is the, you know, kind of like, he's like, what is the point? Because this movie doesn't have, like, a moral message. I think, it, you know, I mean, obviously it kind of does. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have, like, you know, it's more of, like, an accurate telling of these dynamics. It doesn't, like, suggest things that society can do to fix them. It doesn't make you feel good about looking down on them. It doesn't make you feel good about glorifying them, for sure. It just is what it is. It's in, like, a documentary style look into what being a heroin addict in a particular time and place was like. And I think Ebert at the end is like, what do you do with this movie?
And the end of this movie is just a return to the beginning of the movie, right? Like, in a pretty literal sense, like, some of the lines are exactly the same, and he's sort of in a position where I don't think he's gonna move on from this life.
Damn, because it's funny because I thought he did. I thought that this was an arc that he was now on a 180 trajectory, but then I started reading some other people's thoughts and saying that, like, no, this is just... Oh, maybe.
I might have thought that if it wasn't for the dialogue where he's talking about the choice, choose this, choose that, I'm choosing it. I feel like this is a false positive ending.
But, it could be.
But yeah. I couldn't really tell you why. It's just a feeling I have.
No, I mean, it makes I didn't get that, but it makes perfect sense because this movie was a self-contained series, like a Matryoshka dolls, like a series of nested... him making choices to do better, and then eventually, for, you know, reasons understandable, petty, small, large, going back into that. So, like, why would I think that this one is the time that he's really going to kick it? Just because he essentially gave the opposite speech that he did from the beginning, and it's the end of the movie, so I want Ewan McGregor to do well? Because, yeah, like, I think that's just my naivety and my soft head, my soft heart, like, at play. Wanting to, like, yeah, now he kicked it. I can't wait to see T2, where he's 40 in his mid-40s and he hasn't been on heroin for years and he's got a wife and a kid. That's probably not the plot of that movie.
I can't imagine, although it is hilarious that you bring up T2, because I had to go to nefarious means. I had to trade a lot of heroin to get my hands on this movie. It's just not online.
It's not streaming hardly anywhere. Yeah.
Not streaming on Netflix or Amazon, nowhere. I don't have a Google Play device. I can't watch it there. So, like,
I bought it on YouTube, and then the PlayStation player wouldn't show it to me.
Jesus.
So
I did some nefarious shit to get this movie.
Yeah.
However, the first time I tried to do that, I accidentally downloaded T2, and I was watching it, and I was going, God damn, this movie looks amazing for 1996. What fucking cameras and lighting did they use? And then I realized, oh, shit. I didn't realize it until the title card came up. I'm like, okay, he's on the treadmill. He's you know, in good shape, and he's doing things right. When is this going to spiral? And it spiraled right at the title card when it said T2 Trainspotting, and I went, oh, fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
That one's from 2017, by the way, 20 years later.
Yeah. And I heard a lot of people. I feel like the critical opinion of that was not great, but I don't know. Or maybe it's like, you know, why would you revisit this? I kind of want to see it, though, because I like Danny Boyle's films, and I really, really like this film, and I kind of want to see, like, how many people from that world lived, how many people died, what's going on with Renton, all that kind of stuff. But I don't know. Like, one of the reasons I wanted him to succeed is, like, towards the end of the movie, like, the last act, I felt like he was, you know, a lot of times, like, women in abusive relationships, when, you know, I've read some guides about, like, you know, how do you get out of that? Because I think this stuff is, you know, pretty fascinating. And, like, you know, if you're such in a situation, how do you get yourself out of it? And a lot of it is kind of like, you know, slowly, like, get a plan, find a trusted friend, have them hold a duffel bag for you. And then over the next couple of weeks, slowly put some spare clothes over there, some money, some cash. Like, watching him get the safety deposit box and get his passport in order, like, I started to feel like he's trying to leave an abusive relationship. He's got his go bag. He keeps his passport in a safe location. He's setting himself to where he can make a clean break and just disappear. And I want to believe that will work, and that he won't, you know, renege on that choice. He won't go back to being. But
I think I would be with you if it weren't for the fact that he tried that once and failed.
Yeah.
And I don't think, look, if you try something and it fails, I don't think you should give up.
Oh, sure.
And he clearly doesn't want to give up, but I also think that he could be stuck in these patterns. And if he just bounces, if he leaves Scotland, goes wherever he's going to go to get away from his mates, he's also getting away from his support network, which is mm-hmm. his family, who got him clean mm-hmm. in the first place. He's mm-hmm. just committed this big betrayal of his mates, and that's gonna, I think, have to eat away at him. Especially, you know, he goes through the list and says, oh, well, Frank's ridiculous, right? Begbie, he's violent. I can't stay with him anyway. Sick Boy would have done the same to me had he come up with the idea. Spud's the one he feels bad about. And I think leaving him $2,000 is nice, but how much is that going to eat away at him, right? How much is this betrayal? Because, A, he's leaving him half of what he actually was supposed to get.
I thought he did leave him the full 4K.
Was it 2 stacks?
Oh.
I thought it was just a stack, which...
Maybe he did. Maybe
is a
you're right.
Thing to do. And I feel like that's going to eat away at him at some point.
Yeah,
but he's missing his whole support network, which got him clean in the first place. So I'm worried about that.
Yeah, and I just really appreciated, like, there's also the scene where, you know, he's getting into this deal to sell this large quantity of heroin, and how methodically and just reasonably he breaks down the logic of why this relationship is working. It's like, well, I can't trust this guy, but he's got this and this. And he knows this, so he probably won't do this. And this is the reason why this guy is on this operation, because it's like this, like, a psychological and emotional Mexican standoff between this incredibly violent person, this incredibly manipulative person, this person just kind of, like, goes along and gets along, and, like, how those relationships are all proportionately balanced to make this enterprise work. And also, like, the way they celebrate that 16,000-pound score...
Yeah,
which I get it's a little bit like, I just like, I see stuff like that, and I'm just like, this, how is it possibly worth the, you know, prison time? Or, you know, like $4,000 is a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money too.
Right.
And for the way they were kind of, and then of course it just goes bad because They're all, whether it's Bigby with his violence, whether it's Renton with his, you know, whatever, why, you know, I wonder why Rent got into this situation, because he seems like he had fairly solid working class, middle class parents that provided him, like, I don't know, like you cast Jor and you make certain feeling, you know, about like what kind of dad he was. Maybe he wasn't as warm and love, but like, it seems like he's just rebelling against the concept of society. Like, society wants me to do all these things, but I fucking want to be a rock star, and I don't want to do that stuff, so fuck society. And who are the people that also say fuck society? Oh, they're these type of people? Oh, and what do? They do this? Okay, I'm doing that too.
Yeah, it's interesting that that's kind of tied in with, you know, Sick Boy's Sean Connery discussion, and that idea of, like, oh, at some point you just get too old and you can't hack it, and that's, like, his big revelation about life, which is so fucking obvious as a 38-year-old man in retrospect. But like, there's something tied in with that, where like his identity is now this culture, and that culture is moving on from him, right? There's this discussion where he's talking with his underage girlfriend,
Kelly McDonald,
and she's talking about how, you know, drugs are moving on, music is moving on, like everything. You're becoming Sean Connery past his prime. And I think he's that kind of takes him off guard, because he has identified as like this type of person for a while now.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. When Kelly McDonald showed up, I like Kelly McDonald. I've liked her in a lot of things. I especially liked her in Boardwalk Empire, one of my favorite television shows. This is her first role. She's 19. She's playing a 15-year-old. And when they make that reveal she's, and I thought, well, this is going to be a big, this is going to be like a dead baby class disaster. Yeah. Nothing ever really comes of that.
No, I think this is, they should have cut this out of the movie, actually.
Yeah, I almost wonder, like, yeah, like, this was a bigger part of the book, because, like, the way she kind of came in and out of his life didn't really make sense, didn't really track, and they did need her for like that one scene that you're talking about where she talks about how like you're missing your last exit point to get onto a normal life. If you don't fucking hit the exit ramp right here, you're going to go into permanent skid row.
What you're doing is no longer cool, right?
Yeah. And but that's, she has like really two scenes and then that's kind of it.
It's my biggest complaint about the film.
But if they cut that out, then the movie's like an hour and 15 minutes long and then is like really a picture. It's like I wonder like what I would love to see what made the cutting room floor. Maybe this was a really tight film because like as a low budget, you know, sometimes you just run out of film. Like maybe they're going to film some more scenes with her and they just kind of ran out of time. But
you know what they could have maybe padded it out with, which we haven't talked about yet, and it's the most obvious thing to talk about, is the title of this film. Trainspotting. Do you know anything about the term Trainspotting?
So yeah, because I thought it was train surfing, and that's how they got their thing. But the way I understand it is this is like a colloquial phrase from like the 60s and 70s in Britain about someone that's obsessed over a pointless endeavor. Yeah. But it also takes its name from like old guys who would go and watch trains, take pictures of trains, like be obsessed with trains, trainspotters. But I wasn't sure.
Well, there's also a third meaning, which I think is where I'm getting at with the padding out this movie a little bit more. So in the book, there's actually a scene where Frank Begbie meets his dad in a train, who's a homeless man, and he comes up and he approaches him and Renton and just sort of like says, are you boys train spotting? Mm-hmm. And in the context of the book, that actually just means, are you guys here to do drugs? Because a lot of people in that area would go to the train yards to do drugs, shoot up.
It's like
whatever.
Saying you're looking for a shooting gallery if you're in
exactly
the bad part of LA, you know, like it means something different than you would know. Yeah.
And I don't know that I needed like the Frank, the Begbie angle of that, but it would have maybe explained the title a little bit more, because right now it's pretty cryptic as to what train spotting even means in this film.
In fact, I thought like when I saw his room and it was all decorated in trains, I'm like, aha, now I'm going to, in some of these drug fueled visions, I'm going to see the deep, but no, I had to look it up. Yeah. I agree. You take out the Kelly MacDonald stuff. You put in that scene with his dad, because it also explains Bigsby, like, you know, why he is so fucked up, but also like, you know, adamantly anti-drug. If you watch this old man, you know, work himself into being a train hobo through a drug habit, that would make a lot of sense. Plus, we get to see another like fantastic British actor doing some cool work.
Yeah.
One other visual I thought was really good was when he got his first good hit after being on methadone for a long time. He went to see Mother Superior, Jim Delos. And one of the dangers of being a returning heroin addict is when you go back, you want to go back at the level you were at, and now your body can't handle it, and you almost die, or sometimes die. Yeah. And the practical effect of like them showing the inside of the needle going into his veins, and it simultaneously did something, showed how like fucking disgusting that environment is, but also you got this idea that like that was literally like a flushing of something down a drain as it went into the hole, the needle into his arm. I thought that was so fucking cool. And then the effect of him sinking into the carpet and then calling a taxi, and how the guy who just like, you know, has this air of someone that does this all the fucking time. Like, he just literally dumps his body off at the top. And then the way the EMTs or the orderlies are picking him off the ground, like everyone, like that shows just the briefest of the other side of society. And that's where, you know, America has been in the throes of opioid epidemic. And I see sometimes from my own family, people like, having this like, fuck these junkies, you know, like they should just ban Narcan, they should ban, you know, this thing that can save a person's life because they just do it to themselves. And like, you can see how you can get into that opinion if this is, you know, like if you see 100 Rentons coming into the ER a day, you go on, you know, you go on 20 ambulance runs and half of them are Rentons, like imagine that does eat at you. But I don't know, because like it's also like I don't understand like what media these people are watching that they have still in 2020 come to the conclusion that the way you treat addiction is just to let addicts die, to further criminalize them, to drive them further into the underworld of society, to make it dangerous for them to seek treatment and rehabilitation.
It's like a lack of compassion and empathy for people who clearly, are driven to these things by circumstances of their life. They're less than spectacular.
Yeah.
I mean, we've set up our society to sort of not provide any safety, any comfort, any safe space for these people to get better and treat the underlying problem as opposed to just the symptom, which is the drug abuse.
Right.
Yeah. We have a distinct lack of compassion for people in this country.
Yeah. And it is like, it is counterintuitive that policies that are like, you know, more kind and I guess lenient actually paradoxically lead to reduced drug use and increase rehabilitation than just brutalizing them. Because we want to believe that like, well, it's, you know, it's like your child's not doing something right. You tell them not to do it. And if they don't do that, then you yell at them. If they don't do it, then you smack them.
Think about how hard you have to fight to push someone under the water and drown them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you just relaxed a little bit, they'd come up, they'd start breathing, and they wouldn't fucking drown.
Right. Yeah,
that's what we're doing to people. We're holding them under the water. We're using every ounce of strength we have to hold them under the fucking water so they can never get a breath.
Yeah.
And then we shout at them from above the water and say, why the fuck aren't you breathing, you idiot?
Yeah, yeah. It's so easy. Look at me. I'm doing it.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
What else do we want to talk about? Like I said, this is a great movie. I was surprised at how funny it was, and I think that's one of the things that makes it really effective. The first half of this movie is actually a lot of fun to watch.
Oh, yeah.
It's
and
like
when they go to that club, that's fun. Like, there's a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's just gut-busting funny stuff and, like, disgustingly funny stuff, and I think that's what makes the real gut punches land, because it's the stuff that sneaks up on you, and it feels, again, like, more real and more honest than some of the other kind of, like, anti-drug anthems that I've seen the movie is, and I guess that shares a lot of like, you know, Quentin Tarantino kind of Pulp Fiction, where like the movie's a lot of fun until suddenly it's not anymore.
Yeah.
This movie feels very much like that, but never in a way that even in the fun parts, it's like, I never felt like, oh yeah, I want to be Renton. You know, there was no like Tony Montana doing like glamorous coke with Michelle Pfeiffer. Like none of this stuff looked like it was appealing or appetizing at all. None of the environments, none of the like, they're all filmed to look like these are young, healthy, attractive people that are filmed to look like they're on fucking death's door constantly. Mm-hmm. And I like I said, I've never seen that juxtaposition. I've seen like Requiem for a Dream, where it's terrible things are happening to very beautiful, well-shot and well-lit people in very interesting environments. And I've seen things like this where you've got this disgusting, you know, group of people doing disgusting things together, but they're having a lot of fun. You know, like
they
that camaraderie, like what Roger Ebert said, like camaraderie, the understanding, the esprit de corps that they feel as these drug addicts, these outcasts of society. They just really sold that.
They did. Maybe the last thing that I want to talk about is a few moments that are just iconic from this film. We talked about the toilet, which we don't need to go back into those waters.
The worst toilet in Scotland.
Worst toilet in Scotland. It turned out to be. The other one, so there are two others in my mind. When Spud shits the bed.
Oh, God.
And he walks the sheets to the pit. So this is what, his girlfriend's parents?
Yes.
House?
Yes.
Okay. And they end up just covered. Everyone ends up covered in his shit through a mishap. It's iconic. Like, I can't get that image out of my mind.
It turns into a Farley Brothers film at that point, you know?
It does, and it's fun, and it's ridiculous.
It's disgusting, and you know it's going to happen, and it's built up and filmed.
Yep.
The comedic pacing is impeccable. Yeah.
There's a third one, which is by far the most seared into my mind, which is the baby. When Ewan McGregor, when Renton is trying to get clean, and he's in his parents' bedroom, his childhood bedroom, I guess, and this baby is crawling across the ceiling, coming for him. And I knew I knew bad things were going to happen here because he's tripping out, but like, I guess I didn't see the baby's head spinning around,
Exorcist,
staring at him, and then it falling down on top of him was the kind of the kicker.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I will not be able to get that image out of my head for a long time.
Yeah, no, that and the baby, the discovery of the baby, because you knew it's happening. And my only question was, how are they going to show it? Are they going to be tasteful? Are they going? They did the opposite of tasteful. It's just an unflinching, just like, here's a camera and this is what it probably looks like.
Yeah.
Fucking horror show in that crib. And yeah, no, like I said, that I watched it with my 13.5-year-old and I think it made a big impact.
It would have on me, certainly.
And I even told, like, took the time to tell the difference, like, you know, like, there's drugs and there's drugs, and this is a movie about a drug that no sane person should ever, ever try. And if you got any questions about why that is, we can talk about it, but I don't think you will. Because, yeah, like, I just remember so many times he's just like, why? Why? And it's like, because the drug, man. Heroin's a hell of a drug.
I mean, Danny Boyle is great at that, at creating those iconic visual moments. Like, I will never forget the ending of Sunshine, which, if you haven't seen it, sorry for the spoilers, skip ahead literally 10 seconds, where Cillian Murphy is just staring into the big ball of fire as the ship, it descends into it. And I, like, man, that's iconic. The 28 Days Later shots with the city just completely, Cillian Murphy walking out in his hospital gown, completely empty city. I'd never seen anything like it. I mean, Danny Boyle has a way of just creating a moment in his films that are emblazoned into your memory.
Yeah, they stick with you.
Yeah.
He's got a real, real talent for that. All right, that wraps us up for Trainspotting this week. Next week, we'll be back. Jim and I are going to check out 2019's Parasite by director Bong Joon-ho. I saw that movie late last year and quite enjoyed it. Jim, you have not seen it, correct?
No, but I have seen Knives Out, and I think they're roughly the same. So
there is some commonality that we can compare and contrast and discuss. It won Oscar for Best Picture for this year. It's a really good movie. If you guys haven't checked it out, I encourage you to do so, because we're going to spoil the hell out of it. And it's I went in that movie knowing absolutely nothing about it, except for maybe it was going to be a Korean horror movie. And I really liked it. So we'll be back next week to talk about that. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you next week.